This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
I'd like to welcome you all this evening and acknowledge the Indigenous people whose land we're on tonight. Tonight, David Kors is going to speak to us about the work that he's done with the Fellowship. David is a senior curator at the museum and has worked for the NMA since October 84. David is our inaugural Friends Foundation Fellowship recipient, with his proposal an investigation of collections of Aboriginal artefacts and natural history specimens in Australia, Australian institutions collected by David, by Dr. Herbert Bassadeau. David has been researching Bassadeau for some time. David's main research concern in his proposal was that full extent of Bassadeau's collections have never been investigated, and only limited work had been undertaken on Bassadeau as a collector and how he fits into the bigger picture of scientific collecting in Australia. The NMA holds over 1,000 Aboriginal artefacts collected on expeditions in central and northern Australia between 1903 and 1928. At least three other Australian museums hold Aboriginal artefacts, two of which also hold natural history specimens, fauna and geology. The Australian Museum, the Museum of Victoria and South Australian Museum. In addition, the University of Adelaide holds some geological specimens and two herbaria. The Royal Botanic Gardens, Sydney and CSIRO Canberra hold plant specimens collected by Bassadeau. Information to hand indicates Bassadeau collected up to 2,000 artefacts as well as several hundred natural history specimens. With the support of the Friends Fellowship, David hoped to be able to determine the full extent of Bassadeau's collections held in other institutions, to assess their documentation, to relate them back to Bassadeau's expeditions and his activities as a scientist, and to examine the results to see what they can tell us about the NMA's collection. To contribute to this, or produce a catalogue of Bassadeau's collection. So that will be a wonderful resource. All research is a journey, and David is here tonight to talk about Bassadeau, the collections, and where the fellowship journey has led and continues to lead him, because it's a very big subject that you've tackled, David. So thank you very much for coming to speak to us tonight, and thank you all for coming. Thank you. Thanks, David.
Thank you. That one would be good. Thanks. Thanks, Carolyn, and I too like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal. Before I start, I'd just like to say a couple of things. I'd just like to point out a couple of important visitors. My wife, Margaret, up the back there, who's come to... this is the first... Thank you, Lee. This is the first talk that of this kind that Margaret's come to. And I'd also like to welcome Kim Ackerman. A lot of you, I'm sure, have heard of Kim. He's a senior curator here for a couple of years in the late 90s, and amongst other things, he knows more about Aboriginal material culture than anybody else alive. After that introduction, I've actually got a few modifications to some of the figures that will come out. The other thing I'd like to say, though, is I'd like to... Thank the Friends for giving me this opportunity. I've worked with museum collections for almost 30 years and always had an interest for pretty much all of that time in the collections, especially those that are held here in the National Museum. But, I mean, I've always thought, you've got these collections, you know who the collector was, but we don't really know that much about them. And when you start digging, you find out that particularly with the earlier collectors, a lot of them were collecting more than just Aboriginal artefacts. Sometimes, if you look into the history of the museum, you'll see that a lot of the collections came from the old Institute of Anatomy, and only the Aboriginal components or the Indigenous. Sometimes there was a little bit of Torres Strait material or Pacific Islander artefacts also came with those collections. But there are, in addition to Bassadeau, even within this collection here, there are people like George Horn who kept birds, Stan Mitchell who collected rocks and minerals, probably other things as well. Bob Wishart was really big into microscopic examination of things. Who else is there? Anyway, there are others. So I've known for a long time about Basedow that he was collecting material other than Aboriginal artefacts. But it's only with this fellowship from the Friends that I've been able to really examine the extent of those collections. And I have to report that I cannot report and probably never will be able to report on the full extent of those collections. And as I go through this presentation, some of the reasons behind that will come out. So, So just a little bit about Basedow to start with. He was born in Adelaide in 1881. His parents were German. They had both immigrated to Germany. Herbert was the last child of Martin, his father, his second marriage. He undertook schooling in both Adelaide and Germany, a bit of primary school education in Germany. Did a science degree at University of Adelaide, majoring in geology, but did a lot of other important subjects like chemistry, assaying, surveying, and a lot of these came in handy for him later on. In 1907, he went to Germany to study at various German universities until 1910. This is probably his first controversy. There are a number of people who don't, or even at the time, and even some people today, don't accept the qualifications that he got. He achieved a PhD in geology and postgraduate qualifications in medicine in all that short time. Now, he did get some credit for some of the work that he'd done in Adelaide. But anyway, I don't want to go into that. He was a politician in the state parliament from 1927 to 1930. He was re-elected in 1933, but died before parliament sat. He also stood in 1924 and 1930, but was unsuccessful. So, as you can see, he died in Adelaide in 1933. Just a couple of more highlights. The collections that I'm talking about tonight were made on several trips into Central and Northern Australia between 1901 and, well, actually it should be 1900 and 1928. Here he is on a camel on the 1903 expedition into northwest South Australia. A lot of the trips were extended expeditions, including this one, where they're away for about 9 months. Between 1903 and 1911, he held various government positions. He was curator of the Technological Museum and catalogued their mineral collection. In 1906, he worked for the geology department, or the mines department, I should say, in 1906 and 7, 8, or not 6 and 7, but 1910 and 11. And he was also the first Chief Protector of Aborigines and Chief Medical Officer in the Northern Territory when it was taken over by the Commonwealth in 1911. That's another controversial period. He resigned after only being in Darwin for about 6 weeks. And you know, depending on what you read, you get different explanations, but basically he was dissatisfied with the working conditions. Now, he wasn't an easy person to get on with, so I suspect there's a bit of a, you know, bring those things and meet somewhere and you'll get the truth. After he returned to Adelaide, he was a locum doctor for various people, including J.C. Verco, who's another professional who was a naturalist, very big on marine mollusks. And Basedow had been on a few dredging trips with him before he went to Europe. In 1913, he set up his own medical practice combined with a consulting geological practice, consultancy. Over his lifetime, he wrote numerous articles, over 50, mainly in anthropology, quite a few in geology and a few in natural history. And that's him mending clothes on the 1916 trip to the Kimberley. So So just having a brief look at the collection, there are several components to the collection. Objects, so there's both artefacts and natural history specimens and geological specimens. There's photographs and there's papers. They extend across several fields, anthropology and the natural sciences, which I guess is what I just said. But they're also held in several institutions. Right across the country from Sydney to Perth, and there's material overseas. Carol Cooper did a survey of overseas collections back in the late 80s, published in 1989, where there's a couple of collections mentioned there. But there must be some in Germany as well. His family had strong ties to Germany, even during his generation. And he certainly, after the 1903 trip, sent the 600 or so plant specimens that he collected to a botanist called Diels in Germany. But we don't know if they survived the bombing of the Second World War. I just wanted to take a minute out just to say, what would Bazzardo think about the way we look at the so-called Bazzardo collection? I don't think he'd have any problems with the artefacts and the specimens that he collected as being collection material. But today, this museum holds over 2,000 photographs, which we consider to be part of the Bazzardo collection here. The Mitchell Library has a large collection of papers, which they refer to as the Bazzardo collection. So I guess the point I'm trying to make is that what we might see as collection material today might not be the same as what people were looking at in the past, or they might not see their material, their working material, as part of a collection. So looking at a bit more detail, and I've got a table that'll come up in a minute which will have as current figures as I can make them. So there's Aboriginal artefacts, probably close to 2,000. Well, we'll see a figure shortly. There's a small number of Pacific items. Most of them are held here. There's about two or three in Sydney and a couple in Melbourne. And then we start getting a bit more hazy about just what's where. As a geologist, he collected a lot of rocks and fossils and minerals, and I'll talk a bit about his possible motivations a bit later on, but just for now I'll just talk about what is in the collection itself. So these specimens are in the Australian Museum, South Australian Museum, the Tate Museum, which is at the University of Adelaide, and Museum of Victoria. There are animal specimens, particularly invertebrates, but some vertebrates in the Australian Museum, Queensland Museum, South Australian Museum and the Museum of Victoria. And when I say the Queensland Museum, there's one insect, that's it. So you can see the figures are, and the holdings are, or our knowledge about the holdings is quite different to what I originally understood it to be. All the mainland state herbaria hold collections, as does the National Herbarium here in Canberra. Kew Gardens has about 600 plants, and as I said before, we don't know if the German specimens have survived or not. When I put in my proposal, I didn't understand that the herbaria exchange or send out duplicate specimens. All the natural history material and the geological material is stored by species or mineral type or whatever, which, and I'm going to talk about this a bit later. So it's the specimen that is important. The collection details and so on are still important, but they are way down the scale. So if Bazzardo collected five specimens or something and they ended up in Adelaide, well, they might have sent them on to who knows where. Now, looking in a bit more detail, so the institutions across the top are the Institute of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies, the Australian Museum, the Burnt Museum in Perth at the University of Western Australia, the National Museum, South Australian Museum, the Tate Museum and Museum Victoria. Now, the figures are incomplete. Probably the Aboriginal artefacts are the most complete. The reason why I've got 1,350 objects up there as opposed to the up to 2,000 I talk about is because at least in two collections we have original lists, but we can't match all the objects up to those lists. I haven't actually gone through those and try and work it out, because sometimes on the list it says, it might say 78 spears, and then it might say some shields or a few shields or a dozen or approximately. So even from those lists, we can't get a definite figure. When you start talking about photographs, I mean, it's fine here because we can count the... Well, it's almost fine here. We can count the negatives and we can work out with certainty 99.9% of them are bazarros. There's a couple which are questionable. When you start talking about lantern slides and prints, you need to start, you know, knowing about other collections and what other photographers were taking to recognise them, because with the negatives, at least with the Bazzaro collection, you use so many different types of cameras, you can match them to an expedition and you can date them, and so you can get the documentation that way. But with prints and lantern slides, you don't have that. They're all standard up at, well, they might come in different sizes and shapes and things, but they're still standard. They don't correlate with the technology. So we can't tell from the prints. I mean, I can go and look at prints and I can recognise Spencer's photographs or Folscher's photographs, but there are a whole lot of others that I can't recognise. So what we really need to do is look at these total figures as a minimum figure. When you start talking about the natural history material, these are minimum figures. I went through all the registers in the Australian Museum over the last 2 weeks and they list everything that was acquired at different periods from Bazzaro. And they have this column that says number of specimens. Sometimes it means the number of specimens under that name. Sometimes it means a lot of specimens, like a lot as in a group. And then you don't know. There's no way of tracing back how many specimens that means. And that just goes to show there are different ways of looking at the collections as well, because in the certainly in the Indigenous field, we look at the total number of objects. When you're dealing with the natural history collections, it's the species and it's a lot. It doesn't matter whether there's one, well, up to a point anyway, it doesn't matter whether there's one or more specimens. Obviously, it does for statistical purposes and things like that, but when it comes to an acquisition, it's a number and a specimen. And the plants. So far, I've got records of 1,435 plants. However, again, it comes down to a question of how do we count them? On some expeditions, at least, he made multiple sets, or he collected enough material of particular species to make multiple sets. So, for example, in 1916, there are three sets. There's one in Adelaide, there's one in Sydney, and there's one at Kew Gardens. Other institutions hold 1916 material, and that's because various herbarians sent them there. So even though I was looking at Australian collections, I was looking at specimens that had been brought back from Kew, sent back by Kew because they were duplicates. And also, a lot of the specimens have Bazzaro numbers. You can't really... Can you see?
Do we have a pointer?
Yeah. But for this one, that's his number. And a lot of the specimens are labelled. This one's actually a type specimen of Helichrysum bazzardowii in the Adelaide Museum. So I'm going to talk a bit about that sort of thing as well. Because, okay. Thanks. This particular specimen was collected in 1926, I think in the Musgrave Ranges, from memory. And the way this specimen's presented, that's the Adelaide Herbarium way of mounting specimens. I'll show you how Bassetto sent, or how I think he sent all of his specimens once he sent them on to the various herbaria a bit later. I'm just going to quickly run through some examples of all of the different types of material that he collected, starting with the Aboriginal artefacts. On the top left, we have a wooden bowl. It's from the Luritja people in the Western Desert. This might be one that he refers to in his journal in 1903. It's in the South Australian Museum. The spear on the right is in the collection here. And he talks about this spear and illustrates it in his journal. Now, even though the barbs are missing, you can see the stain from the sinew at the front. You can see where the barb at the back one was. And you can also see the little loop that was tied on to the rear barb. I'm going to read three quotes tonight just to give a bit of background information about Bassetto and the way he collected. And the first one relates to the spear. So this is from his 1903 diary, which was published in 1915. Among the belongings of the natives camped around the station, I found a type of spear which is new to me. It is made of one piece of heavy wood, acacia and neura, so mulga, straight and slightly over 7 feet in length. The throwing end is, however, fractured, so that originally it must have been longer. The greater part of the shaft is circular in section, tapering slightly towards the throwing end, but the head end consists of a flat blade about a foot long, with two sharp edges and a point. The new features about the spear is that at 3 and 6 inches, respectively, from the point on the same flat side of the blade, a pointed wooden barb has been tied at an angle of about 30 degrees with kangaroo sinews. Plain heavy spears without barbs and light spears with only one barb are common throughout Central Australia, but I have never found this type before. I have secured the specimen from the owner, who is an Luritja man, on a visit to Todd Morden. So it's Todd Morden Station, northwest of Unadatta, in April. Because this was published so much later, and Bassetto, he effectively rewrote the diary for publication. So it's a bit hard to know 12 years later where he got this information from. Oh, not where he got the information, how he recorded the information originally. I'll talk a bit about that later too. The other object is an ornament collected in the Kimberley in 1916. And I'm sorry, I forgot to check beforehand what that is. It actually, I don't think it's horsehair, but it could be. Now, minerals. The one on the top left is from Germany. This is from the Harz Ranges, and he did attend a university near the Harz Ranges, so he probably had field trips where he may have collected this. It's a bit hard to know when, because he made two trips to Germany. So he could have collected it as a primary school student. He was collecting stuff quite early, but we don't know. All of these specimens are in the Tate Museum, and their register, if you like, is a simple entry of specimen name, place, where acquired, from whom acquired, if they know. It looks to me like it was filled out a long time after things were acquired, or certainly the early materials acquired. Where the information came from, I don't know. There's virtually no original labels with any of the specimens in the Tate Museum. A few of the fossils do, but not much else. Top right hand is molybdenite, a mineral that he collected in southwest of Darwin in 1905. I'll come back to that trip a bit later on. One on the bottom left is Wolfram from King Sound in the Kimberley. He went up. The reason he went up to the Kimberley was to investigate a tungsten mineral deposit that a syndicate of Adelaide businessmen wanted investigated as their contribution to the war effort, because this is in 1916. But he did a lot of other travelling and investigating other mines and deposits and so on. And the other specimen is sulphur from Sicily. So how he got that, I have no idea. Part of the problem is getting records of where people went. I have no record. I've been working on Bazzaro for probably 25 years. I've seen no record of him going to Melanesia. So how he got Pacific artefacts, I don't know. I mean, there was a big trade going on at this time too, so it's quite possible he gave them to someone. Someone gave them to him. Fossils. The top left is probably better regarded as a subfossil. It's not particularly old. Probably post-Pleistocene. Kim might know because it's from the Forest River.
Palisina.
Yep. The three shells at the top right are brachiopods, a type of marine shell. They are all type specimens that he collected, again in the Kimberley, just near Kimberley Downs Station. Bottom left are belemnites. They're animals like squids. They had an internal hard bit, and that's what you see there. That's what gets preserved. They're actually from Europe, and with these original labels above. And that's how I recognised them. I was basically, in some museums, I was told where things might be and left to my own devices. And these specimens are unregistered, but because his label was left with them, I was able to recognise them as his collection. And then also the other three shells on the bottom are from what are called raised beaches. I don't know if they're still called that. They're a geomorphological feature on the beach where the sand dunes get raised up and the shells of the time get preserved in those. Again, they're not very old, but one of his first papers was on raised beaches at Hindmarsh Island, and that's where these specimens came from. So I think we can reasonably assume they were collected about 1901, and he exhibited specimens he collected on the raised beach at Hindmarsh Island at the Royal Society of South Australia. I think we can assume that these are those specimens. Mammals. There are very few mammals in his collection, and I think that's pretty understandable. They've got to be prepared fairly well straight away, so you've got to eviscerate them. You've got to take the brain, get the brain out. You've got to salt them. You've got to cart them around. So in total, he collected two bats, including this one, which is a type specimen. The wallaby is one of the nail-tailed wallabies. They have a little bit of keratinous material at the end of the tail, and that's the skull that goes with that specimen. Birds. The two on the left, the one at the top is a Gouldian finch. When he was up in the Kimberley, he collected some fledglings and took them back to Adelaide. And after they died, he gave them to the South Australian Museum. On the bottom left, there's some Cape Barren geese chicks, and on the bottom right, some Cape Barren geese eggs. He kept Cape Barren geese at his house as well. These chicks must have died there. He bred them. There's a few newspaper reports talking about him breeding them, and he must have been part of a network because he'd give them away, and whether people gave him birds in exchange, I really don't know. On the top right, we have a bird. It's a tit anyway. In a letter that I found only Wednesday? No, today's Thursday. It must have been Tuesday. He described collecting these two specimens. They're both They're a pair, so there's the male and the female. Unfortunately, one's lost its head. But he collected the birds, he collected the nest, and he collected the egg. So a whole set, if you like. Unfortunately, the nest has been destroyed, and I couldn't see any nests or eggs in Sydney because they're all off-site. So, I mean, that's a nice little set, and, you know, it could be... In fact, they were displayed in 1905, which was when he gave them to the museum. Reptiles and amphibians. On the left, we have some eggs preserved in, I don't know, some preservative. They're from Happy Valley in Adelaide. Up in the top right, there's a few small lizards. On the right, there's a dragon from Commonwealth Hill in South Australia, collected in 1917. The next one across is a burrowing lizard from the Kimberley, collected in 1916. And the other one's a gecko collected on one of those trips, I can't remember. Below that are three different species of frogs collected in the Kimberley in 1916. Fish. The one on the left is an eel. I'm going to read you another quote now. When I find it. Okay. So this was collected on the Robinson River, northeast of Derby in Western Australia in 1916. And using the language of the time. Whilst at work, the boys, i.e. the Aboriginal men assisting on the boat that they were travelling on, caught a sea eel, which had left the water and was wriggling in the mud. One of them cautiously handed it to me and said, "This one named Coolangel or Coolangel, him no more sulky bugger." I did not altogether grasp the latter part of his statement, but upon investigation ascertained that he meant the eel was non-venomous. When I placed the captive in a bottle, it became very wild and attempted to bite. It was subsequently determined by the Australian Museum zoologist to be Gymnothorax woodwardii. I'm going to talk a bit about who collected what in his collection a little bit later, so bear that specimen in mind. And there's two other fish from the Kimberley trip. There's only 10 fish that I know of that he collected. So it's the same with most of the all the vertebrates, really. There's not very many. Insects and invertebrates in general are a completely different story. There's hundreds of insects. In 1903 alone, he collected 462 or something, so huge number. Some of them were named after him, the one down the bottom. It was originally Periplaneta bezoedowa. The generic name's been changed. And I'm still trying to get my head around the name changes of animals. It's quite complicated. Stick insect above that, collected in 1916. And on the right, there's a jar of termites. I included that because when he was up there, he actually sectioned a termite mound, and presumably that's when he collected these termites. And he talks about how there was a crowd of Aboriginal people watching him, wondering what the devil was he doing. Crustaceans, mainly crabs, mostly wet specimens, but this group of four dry specimens, which may originally have been wet specimens, so preserved in jar in preservative, probably formaldehyde, and dried out at the museum, but we don't know. Again, collected in 1916. The 1916 trip is probably the one that's got the broadest range of material that we can definitely attribute to, or that's documented as coming from a particular expedition. And there's quite a lot of resource material to go with it. So I've been focusing a bit on that. Mollusks were another big group that he collected, hundreds, if not thousands. Again, a new species, the top left, named after Bazido, Therocydes bazidoi. Cone shell on the right, some freshwater mollusks. So the two on the left are from 1903. The two on the right are from 1916. And I don't know if you can see particularly well, but that scale's in centimetres, so the shell's quite small. And you can see several of them have hermit crabs in them. And plants. You can see Bazzaro's label there. That's from Balmanangara, so Kimberley Down Station. The other one is from Arnhem Land. In fact, one of two sets in Adelaide. That one was identified by a man called Ray Specht, who was the botanist on the 1948 Arnhem Land expedition, the American-Australian expedition, who is still alive and who'll be here at the end of the year for our symposium, who's been helping me try and sort out the Bazzaro 1928 plants, because he wrote an article about it for the volumes for that expedition. Just remember too that that label on the left is in blue. That must seem a bit silly, but a few photographs just to show the range of subjects. And the one on the bottom right is the lantern slide. These are all from the museum collection. We don't have the negative for the one on the right. But all the others are copied from original negatives. And also papers, which are very broad-ranging in their scope and their coverage from material that Bazzaro has written. So the one on the bottom right is his meteorological recordings of the 1903 expedition. If he had only continued to do what he did on that trip, the whole collection would probably be a lot better documented. He kept a book of recording all the photographs he took. He recorded daily weather and weather conditions, sketched a lot, rock art, kept a diary, must have kept other notebooks, but haven't found anything else like that for any other expedition. On the left, from the State Library, South Australia, there's six volumes, of which five are newspaper cuttings, and most of those are about Bazzaro. So he was very well regarded in Adelaide and very popular and very reported in the press. So now, just looking at where and when Bazzaro collected, this is a map you might remember from a different time last year. These show the routes of the main expeditions. I won't go through them, but so we've basically got this area of Central Australia covered, the Kimberley up here, Victoria River there, this sort of region in 1905, and then Arnhem Land was his last expedition in 1928. He did have one planned for 1930 or 31 to look for Lasseter's gold, but it doesn't seem to have come off. And yes, there is a bit more. This is where it starts getting a bit hazy. In 1903 and 1905, Bazzaro was a member of two government expeditions. First one was a prospecting expedition in northwest South Australia, southwestern Northern Territory, which actually was part of the Northern Territory in those days, where they were looking for mineral deposits. They had four prospectors, as they were called, on that expedition. The other three were, as to the best of my knowledge, had no training. Their prospecting knowledge was from their knowledge gained being out there prospecting, probably for gold for their own benefit, no doubt, but nonetheless. But Bazzaro had graduated the year before in geology, so he was actually a qualified geologist. He was very well regarded by both Rolf Tate and Harry Brown. Tate was the foundation professor of natural history, if you like, at University of Adelaide, and Brown was a government geologist. So Brown facilitated Bazzaro's participation in this expedition, and Larry Wells, who was the leader, allowed Bazzaro to use his spare time to engage in anthropology and natural history collecting and so on. And it probably helped that Wells was interested and seemed to have a liking for Bazzaro as well. In 1905, they were doing a geological exploration from Port Essington to the Victoria River, mostly around the coast, but inland around the Victoria River, Catherine and also Melville Island. One of the mineral specimens we saw before was acquired from Basildo, was from that trip. There's a group of fossils in the South Australian Museum. It's all type material, a whole lot of... just in case there's anybody here who doesn't understand, type material is... You have what's called a holotype, which is the specimen from which a species is described, and you have other specimens which may have been collected at the same type, which have different... They're also types but have different names. It's, again, quite complex for someone who's not familiar with that sort of thing. But so there's official expedition collections, if you like, in which Basildo collected. Now, as you can see, they're all mounted on board, but there's only one of them that says was collected by Brown, Lionel G and Basildo. They're the three geologists who are on this trip. This particular specimen... Or let's go back a step. Brown asked Robert Etheridge, who described these fossils, to name one after Basildo and one after Lionel G as recognition of their involvement in the expedition. This one is Nucalana basildoi. It's another brachiopod, another shell, and that's that little thing up there. Also, in 1911, when he was chief protector and chief medical officer, and he made a quick trip to Melville and Bathurst Islands before he left the territory, and made quite an important smallish collection of artefacts, including this group of spears. Now, if you remember, captivating and curious, we had a display of his spears. All of those spears are actually in the collection, and we've located all of them. So the boundary between what we can see as the Basildo collection and his involvement in official collections can be a little bit hazy. When I write this up, I'm going to take the view, I'm going to include both. How I actually define them, I may discuss them separately. I'm not really sure how to deal with that just yet. I still need to think about that one a bit more. Did he collect on all these trips? The answer is maybe. There's certainly material from most of them. I haven't found anything. He went to Central Australia with the Governor of South Australia in 1923, Sir Tom Bridges, but I haven't found anything other than photographs and a map, which he would have probably done afterwards for that expedition. There's no diary, or there's newspaper cuttings, but there's no diary, there's no artefacts that I can say were collected on that trip. There's no natural history specimens in institutions acquired around that time. So he may not have. They travelled in three cars. They would have been hard pushed for space. So if he did collect anything, it can't have been much. So did Basildo collect everything in his... That's the other bat specimen he collected. From Bunbury in Western Australia, collected in 1900. That is one of two surviving specimens from that trip. The other one is a mineral in Sydney, which I didn't get to see. And whether there's other material, it's probably unlikely because there is a letter saying you can have this mineral. It doesn't say anything about anything else. So did Basildo collect everything in his collection? No. But he probably did collect most of it. We don't have any evidence for that. But there are a couple of interesting comments throughout his journals and things which show that he didn't. Aboriginal assistants often gave him things. That eel that we saw is an example. And there are other descriptions in that journal of them going ashore and the men straight away going off collecting things because they enjoyed doing it. Apparently they also enjoyed watching things die in the formulin. They'd go in a jar and they'd be writhing around, and apparently that was good fun. But other assistants also collected shells and different other things on different expeditions. Some are documented, who knows. Frank Feast, who you might also remember from a different time, He went with Bazzaro on four expeditions in 1920, 22, 26 and 28. And he did some collecting. I interviewed him in the late 80s, and, you know, for somebody who's versed in collections and interested in Bazzaro, it was something I didn't really talk to him about. But there's this one interesting quote which I'm going to read. So, starting with Feast. Oh yes, there'd be medicines, and also, from my point of view, there was many, many pickle bottles, because on that trip I'd done all the specimen collecting. Me, what sort of specimens? Frank. Everything that crept and crawled, insects, lizards, spinifex snakes, anything you could get a hold of. And the doctor was particularly anxious to get the small marsupial mice and other marsupial kanga rat about this tall, so about 4 inches. Me. Right, did he get one? Frank. Ooh, I can't remember. And of course, he taught me the names of all the lizards and insects. They all went in pickle bottles and formula near as I can remember, and they went back to Adelaide University. Now, there's a couple of interesting things there for my study. One is formalin, because nowhere have I seen what Bazzaro says he preserves specimens in. He talks a couple of times about taking specimen jars and preservatives, but that's about as detailed as he gets. Could reasonably expect at that time it would be formalin. But transporting a lot of glass jars and formalin and other collecting material would require a lot of space. So it's a bit, you know, I mean, it is an interesting question on which may link into how much he collected or why he didn't collect more, and maybe why he collected some of the things that he collected. So all of the reptiles and the frogs, for example, are all whole specimens. So that means on the trips where they come from, so 1903 and 1916, in particular, he had to have some kind of preservative in jars with him. So that gives you an indication of the kind of luggage he's taking from Adelaide to, say, Central Australia or Darwin, even before he gets into the field. He must have had some knowledge on animal preservation because he's preparing bird skins, and that means getting the whole skin off without damaging it, but also to get the brain out, you actually cut the back of the head off, so the back of the skull off, to get the brain out. And apparently that doesn't, you don't keep that bit of the skull. So this photo is fairly uncommon, showing Bazzaro doing some collecting. They're actually looking for Aboriginal remains on Murphy-Hour Station in 1919. That's Bazzaro there with his pith helmet. That's his brother Erwin and his wife Nell. They only got married a couple of months before they went on this trip. On this particular occasion, the side of the grave kept collapsing so they didn't get their specimens. So what sort of collector was Bazzaro? Well, he was largely an opportunistic collector. He didn't, or he couldn't, whatever, make systematic collections. He wasn't going out in the field like some people to collect all the insects or all the whatevers of, or all the Aboriginal artefacts. He was, seems to have been acquiring what he came across and what opportunity allowed. There's a newspaper story reporting a letter that he sent just before he got back from Germany in 1910, saying he wanted to put his training, medical training and scientific training, to continue expedition work, which is largely what he did. Most of the expeditions were for geological purposes, so he had to fit in his natural history stuff and his anthropology around what he was being paid to do. He was always pretty much always on the go, travelling. There was, so time was an issue. So sometimes he was at a place for a few days and you'll see more material from those places. If you're changing camp every day and collecting, you know, plants have got to be dried, animals have got to be skinned, you've got to take notes, you're writing a diary. So it doesn't really allow for a lot of time. to collect some of the more difficult things. Some things, like mollusk shells, you can just pick up, put in a bag, they're fine. But when you've got whole animals, then you, or you're skinning things, then it starts becoming more of a time factor. So there isn't, certainly with the natural history material, there is an emphasis on the easy to handle. So that's why you've got fewer vertebrates and a lot of invertebrates in the natural history. And that's probably why you don't have a huge range of Aboriginal artefacts. There's between 70 and 80% men's weapons. Now, that's not unusual for collections in those days, but they're the higher profile things. And, you know, certainly by the 1920s, when he was doing a lot of the collecting, there's a lot of people going through collecting artefacts, and Aboriginal people, and say they know what people want and they'll make them and have them ready. So the mode of transport was another factor. And I want to read another quote from Frank Feast, pretty much putting me in my place. In 1928, when they went through Arnhem Land on horseback, no buggies, no wagons, just horses. That Bazzardo did have a pack horse that he could carry things in, but, you know, packs on a horse don't allow you to collect too much. He still collected at least two sets of 208 plants, however, and a few Aboriginal artefacts, but doesn't seem to be terribly much else from that expedition. So I can't remember if this was continuing from the last quote, but we must have been talking about the 1928 expedition itself. What collecting was done on the expedition, Frank? Oh, pack horses. You can't think of any collecting, man. You're damn lucky to have yourself with your prismatic compass or your camera and probably a little bit of a bag. I can't remember how I carried the camera, but I had a carrying case. I could have had the strap of the carrying case over my shoulder. You can't think of any collecting with pack horses. So he also said the same thing about the 1926 trip. Donald McKay, who sponsored that expedition and went on it, they shared a buggy, a small buggy, and which they stored their scientific equipment, radio transmitter and so on, and had camels. And again, the camels obviously can carry a bit more, but, you know, so you need to have the infrastructure or the transport to be able to carry a lot of this material. And when you're travelling in remote areas, you're limited to what you can take in addition to essential stuff like food. And in central Australia, they were carting, I think it was 8 camels alone, just carried water. So that was definitely a factor anyway. Some of the things that we have to hypothesise about is how he recorded what he collected. And here we go back to the original labels that came in with specimens and artefacts with in various institutions. But these all seem to have been, well, certainly with some of the plants, they were after the time, because he wrote the labels on bits of newspaper, and I'll show you in a minute, but some of them are dated after the expedition. So he was obviously referring back to a list. I find it hard to believe that you can remember the details of hundreds of specimens, you know, months after you got back from the expedition. So he must have had less. I mean, it makes sense. It's logical that you would have lists that you would record as you're doing your collecting. But I haven't been able to find any anyway. In the Australian Museum, there is a list of the mollusks that, or some mollusks that he deposited there on one occasion. I only got a copy of that yesterday, so I can't actually tell you what's in it. It's very brief. But I'd say it would have the name of the specimen and where it was collected, and that's pretty much it. They were brief entries. Do we know what Bazzardo's motivations were? It's not really articulated anywhere. There are a couple of comments after he got back reported in the press that he was forwarding his collections onto specialists for description, it seems that he was keen to further science and knowledge. And as a scientist, that would make sense. We're also talking about a time. We're talking about the early 20th century. I mean, there's still stuff out there that we don't know about. So you can imagine what it was like 80 to 100 years ago. There was still a lot to be discovered. So I'm sure that was one of his main motivations. And certainly for Aboriginal artefacts, he was acquiring material evidence of a people that he believed were heading for extinction. He was a product of his time. He always believed that Aboriginal people would become extinct, like most, if not all, of his contemporaries. A lot of even people in anthropology up to the 1960s were saying the same thing. There's also material evidence, and same with the geological material, evidence of the research he was undertaking or the purpose of the field trip. So if he was exploring oil deposits in various places, he'd bring back specimens of that, and presumably he would show that to whoever was funding the trip, and it sent him off. But that's pretty much all I can say, although they're pretty big motivations, really. What do we know about his collecting techniques? Again, not very much. There's the odd reference in diaries, both his diaries. Sometimes we have diaries from other people who went on his expeditions or travelled with him and kept diaries as well. So there was a fellow called Richard Grenfell Thomas, another geologist. In fact, Bazzardo was awarded the Tate Medal for Geology in 1904, and Richard Grenfell Thomas, who went on this trip as an 18-year-old, was awarded it, the Tate Medal, in the 1920s. This was given out by the University of Adelaide for achievement in geology. And Thomas was also an amateur naturalist and doing a lot of collecting, so he was making a lot of observations and occasionally talks about Bazzardo collecting different things. But none of them really talk about, you know, recording the information, how the specimens were dealt with, anything like that. So we really have to turn to what is generally known about collecting practices of that time. So with the plants, for example, talking to Ray Speck, he said that he would have taken a whole lot of newspaper so you could put it in and that would have help dry out the plants, maybe put them by the fire at night, which would speed up the process, presumably. We've already talked about preservatives and skinning animals and so on. So, again, not a lot of information available. We actually know more about how he dealt with the artefacts after he got back to Adelaide. This is through surviving labels, which are not, as far as I can tell, not original field labels. And I'll show you why shortly. On the whole, the information's better for plants because they mostly have Bazzardo's label with them. Some parts of the rest of the material have good documentation, particularly 1916 Aboriginal artefacts, and a lot of the specimens in the Australian Museum collected on that trip as well, again because they have Bazzardo labels with them. In other collections, including the National Museum's collection, it's very sporadic what has original information that can be linked back to Bazzardo. So if you remember that photograph of the spears I showed you, we know they were collected in 1911 on Bathurst Island because they were published and that documentation comes with it. Otherwise, we'd have to attribute them to Melbourne Bathurst Island based on the form. Tiwi material culture is very distinctive, but and given that he only went there once, you know, it's pretty obvious that he collected those artefacts on that trip, but we do have that documentary evidence to go with it. But when you start talking about, say, Central Australia, where the material culture is much more widespread and where he travelled, you know, much more frequently, it's almost impossible, and in most cases it is impossible, to tie particular artefacts to particular trips, which means we can only give them a date range and a geographical range. Some parts like Casa Nullarbor and Cooper Creek are a bit more distinctive and can be attributed to expeditions, however. And as far as I can tell, there's no way of locating that information. But you can always hope. Now, talking about the plants, the two big collections are in Adelaide, in Australia anyway, are in Adelaide and Sydney. When I went to Adelaide, the like we saw before, there were those big sheets with all the labels glued to them and the specimens attached. Some of the labels are herbaria labels. People go through when they're studying them, and if the specimen's not identified, or if the name has changed, or if it's a wrong identification, then they put another label on. So that's why there's so many labels on some specimens. But in the Sydney collection, there's a number of specimens that look like this. They're in Adelaide newspapers because some of them have got the top and we know it's the Advertiser or the Register. And there's Bazzardo's handwritten label glued on in this case. So you remember I asked you to remember that blue label written in blue pencil? That's because it was, as far as I can tell anyway, it was taken off one of these labels, one of these sheets. And there are, for the 1903 expedition, there's quite a lot of these. And this one's from 1920 and there's one from 1919. So I think that's pretty good evidence that when he was preparing plants to send them off, that he was individually wrapping them in folded newspaper and labelling them separately. Now, with the plants, the blue label, the other reason I wanted you to remember that is because in blue, the Adelaide 1916 specimens are in blue. The Sydney specimens are written in red. They have the few that I've seen of the same species, of the same number, have the same information. So that tells me either he intended to collect more than one set before he went out, or he collected enough material to make up multiple sets. Obviously, we don't know. Now, this is one of the specimens from Kew Gardens. You can actually go onto the Kew Gardens website and see a lot of Australian specimens. They have data and a lot of them have images. Apart from the fact that this is another species of grass, or another species named after Bazzardo, Penicetium, I think it is, Bazzardo. You see this label here. I don't know, can you read that? It says Dr. Herbert Bazzardo's Australian Explorations. And it records the species, locality, date, and remarks. And at some point, he had these printed up and used them. How broadly, don't really know. There's plants from 1916 and 1928 in Kew with these labels. No Australian specimen that I have seen has that label on it. And I was looking in a cupboard here one day and I found 9 of them that hadn't been used. So that's the closest thing, other than artefacts, to Bazzardo's collecting that we hold here in the National Museum. Now, some of the difficulties that we encountered. Not everything goes smoothly. Like I said before, most of the Indigenous collections are data-based. So of the Bazzardo material that is known in collections, we can pretty much locate. Natural history collections are a different kettle of fish. They're huge. Some of them number millions of specimens. And databasing of those is happening. But when you say you've got you know, 1.5 million insects in your database, 10%, you can start understanding the magnitude of the problem of trying to locate all the specimens that were collected by one person. So basically you can't do it. You can't go through rooms with drawers like this and look through everything. The labels, I should have put a photo of the insects in. The labels are tiny. They're like this big under the specimen. So what they do with insects is, because they're the dry specimens are pinned, and there might be 100 or more in a box, they pin every label that they have under the specimen. And understandably, the collection managers don't want to go through everything looking for specimens. So unless you've got a name and a geographical region, which is the way these things are organised, it's very difficult to locate things. Some collection managers are more enthusiastic, shall we say, about helping you than others. But most of them were really good and really great and, you know, gave me a lot of time. But, you know, just when collections are stored like that, it's hard enough finding the right drawer, let alone the right specimens. Bezzolo's example of... two examples of these, this species are in there somewhere, or maybe it's those ones. The other problem we encountered was that everything that goes in the database goes in under its scientific name at that time. So, you know, probably in 99% of cases, they're current names. But the specimens that were collected before 1930, quite often with different names, and that doesn't get recorded in the, or it does get recorded, but I don't think it's in the database. So if the name's changed and the collection manager or whoever's doing the search for me don't know the change, because you can't be a specialist in everything and have that knowledge in everything, although some of them were getting pretty close, you can't trace them without a lot of work. And, you know, if he collected, you know, 150 different species of insects, then you can see it's a big job. So once I started understanding this, I realised I was never, there was no way I was ever going to work out the full extent of his collection. Come back in 100 years and I reckon probably could, but... So now, well, I just changed the way I approached the project, and that was to get a broad understanding of what he collected and try and get an idea of, within different species, how many specimens he was collecting. And even when a number of specimens were acquired and entered under a name, somebody coming through later would say, oh no, you've got four species here. And so then they get taken out, re-registered. So you might have numbers in one area, but unless that they tell you how many specimens were taken out and re-registered, then, you know, your figures are going to be higher than what they really are anyway. And so that's the other thing that I had to start rethinking, was just how important is quantity. And I guess that comes back to the way I've looked at collections in the past. We always look at how many, look at how many artefacts someone has collected, because I've mainly worked on Indigenous collections, and that's always been a question of interest. Even when I talk to colleagues, it's a question of interest, but natural history scientists are interested in species and places, and the numbers and other things come later, if at all. I looked a little bit broader than just what he collected in the sense of new species that Bezzolo collected. There's at least 20, but I suspect there's more. I only found out this week that new species of bat was a type specimen, and I didn't know that he was involved in collecting that. So, you know, the internet's a wonderful resource when you go to the right sites, and I've actually located a lot of species that either named after him or that he collected type specimens of through various institutional and government websites dealing with flora and fauna. I suspect the figure's going to be higher than that by the time I've worked it out. Most of them, but not all of them, were named in his lifetime. There were scientists after Bazzo died who recognised his achievements, and one species was named after him in the 30s or 40s in recognition of that, his contributions to the sciences. He did have knowledge which enabled him to identify new species. Susan, I was going to grab a drink. So he did have this knowledge, and that was probably partly gained through the teachings of Ralph Tait, I suspect, who was, again, another all-round scientist and collector. But the only concrete example of that is this plant here, Pandanus bazzadoi, which he recognised as soon as he saw it that it was a new species. Now, most Pandanus grow along water courses. This one is actually in the dry escarpment country in Arnhem Land. There's only one other species of Pandanus, I think, I'm pretty sure, that also grows in dry country, and that's in Queensland. And in his diary, Bazzo mentions why he thinks it's a new species, because it's a more similar to another genus of plants. But he also mentions some of the differences. And this is a photograph of the species that he took in 1928 in Arnhem Land. And this photograph was reproduced in the original description by Charles Wright of Kew Gardens, who named it after Pandanus bazzadoi, not bazzadoi. Early in Bazzadoi's career, he was naming new species of fossils and some marine invertebrates. These are nudibranchs, sea slugs. Of the several species of nudibranchs that he did describe in 1905 with Charles Hedley, only one is now regarded. One of the names is still regarded as being the same as when Bazzadoi described it. Some of the others, the genus has changed, or the entire name has changed. In one case, they didn't recognise that they collected a juvenile specimen of another species, so they named it whatever they named it, I can't remember now, and somebody coming along later recognised it as being a juvenile specimen, so that name is no longer valid. I included this image because that paper has a number of colour illustrations, all of by Bazzadoi, and this is quite a nice one. I think this is one of the species, though, that's no longer regarded as being valid. With the fossils, some were described with Ralph Tait. There's a paper where Bazzadoi described some species, Tait described some, and they described one or two together. I think that's probably another indication of the regard that Bazzadoi was held in by Tait working with him, mentoring him, I guess, in his career, very early in his career. So just about to finish, was Bazzadoi the only broad-ranging collector of his time? No. A lot of people were collecting broadly across this time, across different fields. I mentioned at the beginning some of the collectors in the National Collection who were collecting more than just the indigenous artefacts for which are held here. Some were as broadly focused as Bazzadoi. Some just collected narrowly in maybe minerals, geology. Some might have collected minerals and rocks. Some might have collected fossils as well. Some collected animals and artefacts. So there's a whole range of what people were doing at the time. I didn't look with plants. I didn't look in any registers or anything, so I don't know as much about plants, but I know that people like Tate, Baldwin Spencer, Roth, and a lot of other eminent people were collecting right across, including plants as well. And again, these people come from a range of backgrounds. Science in those days was partaken of by not just scientists, but a lot of people. People on the land who had an interest in natural history would collect and quite often send material to their state museum or made up their own collections and kept them. There are other doctors like Bazzardo and Verco, but probably, you know, right across the field of different employment you'd find people, different backgrounds. Has this research helped to better document the museum, the National Museum's collection? Just by way of background, the museum has a large collection of Aboriginal artefacts and photographs from Bazzardo. And only parts of these collections can be considered to be well documented. When the collection was being prepared to come to Canberra from after Bazzardo died, Norman Tyndale of the South Australian Museum processed the collection for the Commonwealth, who bought the collection, and he wrote his attribution of usually a place on the artefact, like he did with artefacts in the South Australian Museum. And so it's probably pretty clear that not many of the artefacts that came here had labels, because they've all got these really general attributions: Central Australia, maybe Northern Central Australia, sometimes Cooper Creek or something a bit more specific. And then there's the material that we can document through various processes like the publications or those few things that do have original labels on them. One thing I did find out was that some specimens Bazzardo labelled in pencil, and I have found some on some National Museum objects, but I'll have to go through a lot more to see if it's more widespread. But so the main benefit is that broader contextual information about what Bazzardo was doing. And even though some of it's conjectural, or it's still, there's a lot of factual information that gives us a really good background to what Bazzardo was doing. So, that's all.
My name is Tom Campbell. I came here to the museum in December 1983 as one of the first five or six. And it was in about this time, in 1984, that the museum's council was told that it was being given responsibility for the Australian Institute of Anatomy collection over in the old Institute of Anatomy building, what's now the Film and Sound Archive. And I was detailed off as the general factotum to make the people over there welcome, make them feel part of the museum family. I went across and met a delightful lady called Noel Keith, who then took me. She said, "I have a colleague downstairs." And downstairs I was taken into the bowels of the institute and was introduced to this young, intense young man called David, who promptly took me into the a big room, or a tight room, but there were drawers and drawers and drawers of rocks. And he was starting to get enthusiastic about rocks. So I now know that they were Baisdell and other collections. But it's been a long time since then, and the Institute collection at that stage had so much Aboriginal material and ethnographic material, and there was big Pacific collection, etc. And a lot of that has subsequently been separated off and gone back to the University of Sydney and other places that belong to them. So it's frightening to say that David has been around for 35 years inside the National Museum, and registrar, a fellow called Jeff O'Donnell, came down here from the Australian Museum in Sydney, and I'm just so glad that he didn't know how many insects were in that collection, because we were in that 1986 somewhere, we were busily trying to persuade the government of the day that we had a big collection, and we had just acquired a printing press out of Echuca. So Jeff actually counted every single piece of type from out of there and put that in. We have a collection of 100,000 objects or something, and it was all because of these individual typefaces. So thank God he didn't know about all the insects and that, but it's just a wonderful thing. It's lovely to see the result of this young man's time and effort that he spent in over 35 years, and it's just a related little single issue. It is just so wonderful to see the father of a lot of this industry, John Mulvaney, sitting here, and I'm thrilled to see him here as well. So well done, David.
And the thing that I wanted to mention too is tonight we're going to announce our fellowship for this coming year, and I'm delighted to say that it's Carol Cooper is the winner of the awardee, I think. It's always difficult to decide who is going to get a fellowship like this, but we're delighted that it's Carol. So congratulations, Carol. I have a little bit of information about her. Carol has been the manager of registration with responsibility for managing the intellectual and physical control of the National Historical Collection at the National Museum since 1998. For 2009, Carol is a research fellow at the Centre for Historical Research, and so she's involved in researching the visual culture of the 19th century Aboriginal Southeast Australia, development of the Barak painting expedition with Howard Morphy at the ANU, liaison with the Moriarty family for the acquisition of the Barangiri archive, and John Moriarty personal collection by the museum. The co-curator of the Colonial Melbourne Historical Module for Creating a Country, which we're all looking forward to. Oral history research with the Maple Brown family from the Centre for Historical Research Materials Historities Project. Carol's Foundation Fellowship proposes involving her concluding the significant research that she has initiated on the drawings of 19th century Aboriginal artist William Barak. The fellowship will allow her to travel to selected European museums to undertake detailed study of the earliest Barak drawings to finalise her research and make definitive statements about the subject matter of the drawings. The major outcome will be a publication presenting the stories told by Barak Art, illustrating the works held within both Australian and overseas collections. Indigenous community involvement and liaison would strengthen existing relations with Barak's descendants and the wider Melbourne Koori community. It is the hope of both Carol and the Friends that this book will be published by NMA Press. The material presented in the book has the potential to make an interesting and attractive website project. So, Carol, thank you, and we'll all look forward to your work when you've had an opportunity to go ahead with that. Thank you all for coming, and please, if you would like to ask David some questions, which I'm sure you would like to, please feel free to do that. Thank you once again for coming, and we'll look forward again to seeing you at a Friends function. Good night.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.